Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio, a couple nights a week for the listening discomfort of those of you who don't like uncomfortable things like the truth. You know, if you're really not comfortable with it, if you just don't like it, please stop listening to this show and please stop leaving YouTube comments and please stop contacting me on Facebook and things like that. If you're uninterested in finding out whether or not the base assumptions upon which you are living your life are correct or not, and are willing to question those for the time period of your life, don't listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. If, however, you are sick of being treated like a child, you're sick of people doing your thinking for you, you're sick of having people cut down to a 30-second soundbite that doesn't mean anything anymore, then do listen to this show and do donate. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and americanfreedomradio.com respectively and give us a couple of dollars a month just to make sure that we can just keep this broadcast going. Do we give you anything for your donation? No, we don't. Do we ask anybody to pay for any part of the services that we provide and all the audio and all the video services? Everything? No? No, we don't. Okay, it's a symbiotic relationship. Without a population that is informed and without information getting to them, they can't make informed decisions. It's just that simple. And you cannot pay people to spread the truth for you. You can only pay them to spread lies. That's why, if you donate to us, you get nothing in return except the truth. My very special guest joining me tonight, the somewhat legendary, I was talking to a Jewish friend of mine from New York, and he's like, "Oh my God, you're getting glad as my mom. He's fucking legendary, man. He's legendary." Yeah, and there was some mention of his left arm being cut off if he got to ask you a few questions and things like that. But it's Gilad Atzmon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show, mate.
It's a lot of pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Can you give us a little bit of a background about yourself, who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, I'm a jazz artist. I play all over the world. And I'm also a writer. I wrote a few novels. And in the last 15, 16 years, I decided to write non-fictional materials. I'm specializing on Jewish identity politics. I try to understand this unique phenomenon, and I'm probably one of the biggest experts on the topic, and not necessarily because I'm the cleverest around, but mainly because I'm probably courageous enough or stupid enough to deal with this very dangerous topic.
It's a fine line between courage and stupidity. I think there's a fine line between naivete and intelligence as well sometimes.
Yeah, this is definitely the case. I still try to figure out whether I'm uniquely clever or extremely stupid. And I didn't come with a conclusive answer yet.
Well, once a wise man figures out the truth that he's wrong, he'll either cease to be wrong or cease to be honest.
This is definitely the case. When it comes to be, I cannot think of anyone, even my most bitterest critics, do agree that I'm honest, but they argue that I should talk about those topics I indulge myself and others into. And as I mentioned many times, this helped me to define what Jewish power is. Jewish power is the ability to stop us discussing Jewish power. And it's definitely a power which they celebrate in our midst, Jewish oligarchy especially. And I argue that this is one of the main reasons that our universe, everything around us, is falling apart.
I thought about the universe this morning. If you say the universe wants things this way, or the universe wants things that way, or the universe is with me, or the universe is against me, it's a way of saying God without having to explain what a macroorganism is.
This is a very astute comment, what you have just said, because in the common usage of the word universe, we admittedly refer to something that is very subjective. It is the way we interpret that thing in which we are in its very center. It is very, very interesting. I have to think about it a bit, but I can already see that I am challenged here by an intelligent person, which is not usually the case. Good. Good for me. I'm lucky.
Yeah. When I was in high school, I found that I learned nothing from the people of my own age and my own intelligence. I always learned more from people who are older and a little bit wiser than me.
Being older than you is not necessarily an indication of wisdom. Usually it is actually, I just finished 2 hours a red show. You are actually still very young. When you will get a bit older and you will have kids. Do you have kids already? I don't know. Maybe you have kids.
Not yet.
Not that you are aware of. You will find out that actually the most fundamental insights are on the verge of simplistic. And this is why we can actually learn much more from the youngsters, which is very, very interesting. Education, especially in the post-68 revolution, is in general different forms of indoctrination. This is the whole philosophy behind left thinking or contemporary left thinking. Rather than teach you how to think for yourself, they tell you what to say, what is right, what is correct, what is politically incorrect, what not to say. And the more education you're subject to in the contemporary universe, I use the word universe, the less you are able to think creatively, authentically, and for yourself.
Which is more or less getting stamped out day by day through a number of different means. We've seen this in particular. The American population are affected more than any other by entertainment, drugs, and bad food. And if you wanted to corrupt somebody's thinking processes, keep them entertained so that they don't have to use them, and if they start using them, keep them doped up on psychotropic drugs.
This is very interesting because in the real world, you cannot think for yourself, but when you take the right drugs, you tend to believe that you are authentic to yourself and you own your thoughts, but in general, you become more and more dysfunctional. So even if you manage to touch yourself, you get nowhere. And now I'm a jazz artist, and it is hardly a secret that the greatest moments within the context of jazz development were in this music was dominated by narcotic materials. Jazz is now extremely clean. My band is clean. I'm clean for many years. And the music is actually becoming more and more clever, but less and less interesting.
More clever and less interesting. Does that mean there's more work going into it because you're not wasted all the time, but there's less creative thought flowing out because you're not wasted all the time?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think that this is what it is. In England, I don't think that in America they use this word. I don't know about... You are in New Zealand, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you
yeah.
use the word muso?
Yeah, yeah.
Muso, yeah? And what it means for you?
Muso, a musician.
Say muso. All right, okay, so in Britain, muso is how you slag off a musician who is very, very witty. He can play the saxophone, he can do some pyrotechnical stuff, but there is very little emotional, really exciting stuff involved with it. Mm. So we are becoming more and more muso and less exciting. And generally speaking, our political discourse is not very different. Yeah, so we see a lot of people speaking through camera. The camera appeals to them and they speak eloquently, but they actually say very little. And I believe that we are living in a very interesting time because despite the desperate attempt to suppress the truth, which is an ongoing project to suppress our humanity, the truth has this unique, relentless tendency to manifest itself. And this is exactly what we see now in Britain with the Brexit, which is very, very interesting. For years, we learned that we should never talk about immigrants. I'm not an anti-immigrant. I'm an immigrant myself. You can hear that I can hardly speak English. People here were told that they cannot talk about immigrants and they cannot think about nationalism and about being Brits. And they were suppressed under this heavyweight cultural Marxist indoctrination. And then as soon as they had this new political tool, the Brexit, that allowed people here to say, all right, I'm British, actually. I want to be British. I don't want to go to the park and to see all those people from all over the world. I'm tired of immigration. And a lot of people now supporting it. We saw exactly the same thing in Scotland. Once they had the political outlet to express their inclination towards authenticity, towards nationalism, towards patriotism, they dumped the left, they let it die. The Labour Party was annihilated in Scotland, which is a fascinating development, and I'm very cheered by it.
It does seem that the reason why so many people are currently suppressed is that the easy option to just go and tick a box and make yourself free doesn't exist.
This is a very interesting insight. I'm definitely not a follower of Theodor Adorno. Actually, I despise the Frankfurt School and his project, but he came with one interesting insight. Even Noam Chomsky came, I think, in his entire life with probably one or two clever ideas. It can happen. Adorno realized that one of the symptoms of Western society is that we cannot understand what are the boundaries of our freedom because we are supposed to be free. Where if you lived at the time in USSR and you knew that you cannot talk about that and that and that and that and that and that, about Stalin or Gorbachev or whatever, or to explore your whims or wishes to drink Coca-Cola or to buy an album of Whitney Houston, you knew exactly what were the boundaries of freedom and you can then celebrate your freedom. What is very interesting is that whether we realized it or not, we have become subject to a very suppressive, castrating system, oppressive system, namely political correctness. Now, what is political correctness? Political correctness is politics that doesn't allow political opposition. Now, politics that doesn't allow political opposition is actually the definition of dictatorship. We are living here in the West. We see ourselves as free people, but the system that dominates our life is actually tyranny of correctness. And the tyranny of correctness is led by the so-called righteous. I do believe that liberation, for us, emancipation, is the removal of all forms of correctness from our speech, from our ability to think correctly. We have to move forward, and this would mean leaving the progressives behind. To move forward is to drift away from the progressives.
Yeah. I think some people devote themselves to a particular type of belief, you know, and it's either a religious belief or a political belief, generally speaking. And it allows them to say, okay, I've now figured out the truth, all of it. And I know all the truth now because I've become a libertarian. I know all the truth now because I've converted to Islam. I know all the truth now. And this is what is causing the misunderstanding of what's correct. Because when you're trying to only discover the one truth, it means you're not looking for other answers that also answer the same questions. I think there are many, many different ways to the top of the mountain. And when people are willing to make their mark. They're willing to draw it in the sand and say, this is the way it is supposed to be. This is absolutely 100% correct. And I will not question it. That's when we start to get into trouble. That's when we start to have extremism, the racism, you know, these genuine things which just get hyped up by the media and get used to throw everybody against each other.
I tend to agree with you. And the way I look at it, I differentiate between those who provide answers, which is, by the way, a left symptom. Leftists always will tell you, activists tell you, we have to do that, we have to do that, we have to boycott Israel, we have to come on Monday, there is a picket, or so on and so on. There are people who always know the answers, and there are less, not many of them really, people who see their task as refining the questions. I think that my job, and I'm quite good at it, is refining the questions. I'm really more and more interested in questions. I'm not interested in answers. Once you understand the question, you can come yourself with three or four different answers. For instance, the question is not what the truth is, pointing at the truth. The real question is how we discuss the questions relating to the truth.
How would you know if the truth was the truth if you found it?
How you know that the truth is the truth, you know? By the way, once you understand the questions, you can deal with the different answers. For instance, some people, if you are a scientific person with empirical orientation, you would say, if you want to talk about the truth, you have to define now a correspondence rule, that the truth has to relate that something that can be verified. But other people will tell them, no, but some truths are emotionally related or a priori related, and we are not so sure that we can verify it empirically, you know?
That's the difference between subjective truth, this is my truth, and objective truth, this is the truth. It doesn't matter who's looking at this box, we can all see a box.
Yeah, exactly, and when it comes to that point, you transcend yourself way beyond the banal discussion that is related to religion versus atheism or moronic debates between competing answers. I'm actually more interested in competing questions.
Wait, hold on a second. The main debate that's going on in society is between the insane and the stupid. That's why nobody can find any answers. Because the only people that are actually seeming to be joining in the debate and actually letting their voices be heard 1,000 times a day through all the airwaves are either really stupid or freaking crazy. And it's confusing all the sane, intelligent people as to thinking, am I alone? Am I like one of the few? Like, are we dying out here? Are like stupid, crazy people going to like bust down my door and invade me with guns and things of this nature because some crazy person told them to put a stupid gun in their hand and march their stupid asses down into my grave? Is that going to happen soon? And a lot of people are thinking it is. And what the problem is with that idea, though, is it's acting out of fear. It's about thinking that these people are stupid, these people are crazy, as if they're not just people that are just like you.
But what you are describing here is a typical exchange between the rational and the irrational. Now, again, we are foolish enough to think that these are necessarily two opposing poles, rationality and irrationality. When it comes to the human subject, it is very clear to us that our excitement by a piece of architecture, music, love, these things cannot necessarily be described in rational terms. So we have to accept that we are at least as much irrational as we are rational. And we have those components struggling within each of us. In fact, those who cannot think irrationally are probably psychopaths. I believe that once we understand the power of irrationality, we become much more capable of understanding the political subconsciousness that we see around us. So, for instance, the debate about staying in the EU or leaving the EU here in Britain seems to be a rational debate. But actually, the impetus of people to leave the EU is not necessarily rational. It's a form of belonging, desire to be who you are, to be surrounded by people like yourself. And those issues are more emotional and can be described in a much more powerful manner in poetic terms. And one of the reasons that we cannot really deal with irrationality is because we are living within a moronic, technological, pseudo-scientific realm. We think that everything can be described precisely in scientific, chemical, biological, technological terms. And this is a very wrong perception of the human subject and the human experience.
The right perception is having a healthy sense of irony, I think, and contradiction. I had a saying a couple of years ago, and so far I've been proven to be correct. History makes hypocrites of us all. What we once thought, once upon a time, is different today. And we're hypocrites, retrospectively, aren't we? And it just means that everything's in a circle. Right, where you figure out the truth right here, it comes full circle again, where you figure out another truth to replace it, or the thing that you threw aside, an old idea that became forgotten about, comes back, and people think that it's revolutionary.
What you're saying here is very, very interesting, because, you see, the human condition didn't change much in the last 15,000 years. Biologically, this can be proven. All right, we developed technologically, but we are still struggling with temporality. You know, we are born against our will, and we are thrown into this reality, and we have to survive, and eventually we turn into nothing.
We're domesticated high-tech cavemen.
And then we will try to fill this time we stay on this planet with meaning. Which is quite a crazy idea. Why do we talk about truth and 9/11 or Palestine? What is this nonsense? Let's just have fun, eat good food. But survival is not very easy. Food is not put on our table. We have to struggle for it. So there is this existential Sisyphean element. And when you start to look at your existence from that metaphysical perspectives, you realize that the thing that you are struggling with are not different from the ancient Persians or the Greek or the people that will live on this planet in 2,000 years, assuming that the planet doesn't annihilate itself.
And I can back that up because there was a quote from Plato a couple of thousand years ago, which is still being used today. He says, "I'm a wise man, and the reason why I know that I'm a wise man is because I know that I know nothing."
Yeah, I tend to agree with it. And
But let's talk about Jewish identity for a second here. I mean, switching gears a bit. When did you start thinking about that as a concept and want to start writing books about it and actually start discussing it? Did you have like a trigger, or was it a long, slow build-up of things?
I think that when I lived in Israel, I'd never thought about those topics. And one of the reasons is because as a product of the Zionist project, I wasn't educated as a Zionist because I'm kind of a post-Zionist product. You know, when I was born, Israel was already established for 15 years. So I never had to engage myself in Zionist issues. I'm a product of an Israeli patriotic upbringing. And since the Jews were the majority of the people on the land, the Palestinians were brutally expelled and so on. And I wasn't at all bothered by Jewish issues. When I came to Britain, I also didn't really engage myself with a question to do with Jewishness because I didn't feel any need to sustain my Jewishness because I wasn't a Jew to start with. I was an Israeli. But then in 2000, 2001, 2002, at the time of the Second Intifada, I was pretty devastated when I looked at the TV, The Guardian, BBC, CNN at the time. I was pretty devastated to see the people whom I believed then to be my people treating the Palestinian that badly. And I tried to understand what was it. How did the interpretation of the Bible as the core of our historical claim for the land started to fill us with all that brutality? I started to dig into Zionist history, the role of Jewish understanding within the notion of the Jewish state. I realized for the first time, while being in Britain, that if Israel is the Jewish state, the first question that we have to ask ourselves is, who are the Jews? What is Judaism? What is Jewishness? How those terms are related to each other? How they are related to Jewish politics abroad and so on and so on. I realized that the main questions to do with Israel are J-related. They are related to the J-word. Shockingly enough, the first people who picked on me and tried to silence me and later to destroy my musical career and so on, were, funny enough, the Jewish Marxists. The people who were supposed to be in my side. The people who were supposed to be atheists and cosmopolitan. But they were very clear. They told me, never, 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 never mention the J word. Don't go beyond the Z word, Zionism. I said, why? How can I talk about Zionism? I was an Israeli. I never been a Zionist. My parents were born in Palestine. They never been Zionist. They were the product of the Zionist project. Zionism is really foreign to us. It is Judaism, Jewishness, and the Jewish people. This is the project. And when this happened, I decided that I will dig into the J concept and understand it. And I'm working on it now for 10 or 15 years. Probably, not probably, certainly, my book, The Wandering Who, is the best-selling book on Jewish identity politics. And it is a very interesting project because we are dealing with a very, very sophisticated identity, with an identity that evolved for 2,000 to 3,000 years. Jewish survival strategies are varied and very, very sophisticated. Also, you know, some people think that Jews are uniquely clever. I actually argue that this is not the case, but they definitely, and I can explain how they did it or what led to such a situation, a Jewish oligarchy, Jewish elite is uniquely sophisticated, especially in scholarship and money. Something to do with a social exercise that took place in the Jewish ghetto for 1500 years. And all those issues are fascinating, and we must look into them because, as we know, Jewish elite dominates Western politics, American foreign affairs, Western media, Western banking, and whether we like it or not, the world we are living in is not in a good way. And this is the first place to understand Jewish identity politics is where we must dig. And it's quite depressing that around the world, I believe, there are no more than 5 or 6 academics who are dealing with these issues. And all of them are basically subject to huge smear campaigns. They obviously don't have access to media. You can talk about E. Michael Jones or Kevin MacDonald, myself. This is actually my third interview today, but everything I do is within alternative media. And it is for a reason, because Jewish power is the power to silence discussion on Jewish power.
It's all-powerful, really. If you think about what you call the Jewish lobby, it's perfect, because instantly anybody who uses the word Jewish or Jew, anti-Semite, instantly. Right? Doesn't matter if there are people who are Jewish or are Jews that are involved in any kind of scumbaggery. It doesn't matter that you're singling out Zionists, because they can carte blanche blanket everybody who questions them in any way with the label racist, anti-Semite, and then quote the Holocaust. And then, boom, you silence the debate. Now, I think it was Voltaire said, if you want to find out who's in control of your society, figure out who you're not allowed to question. What is the only group of people that you're not allowed to criticize or even discuss on mainstream news?
You're absolutely right. And the fact that you are talking about it and understanding it, and not necessarily thanks to Gilad Atzmon, you're just living in the world and you see what is happening, is a very positive development. And I can see that I contributed to this change. And I don't have any doubt that sooner or later, there will be this huge empowerment will backfire. Learning Jewish history reveals that it always leads towards a disaster. Jewish history is basically a chain of Holocaust with a few tea breaks. Because of a reason. There is a reason. And we have to understand what are the responsibility of the Jews. Because if we don't point out where the problem is, we don't just betray ourselves, we also betray the Jews amongst us. They have this tendency that is embedded in their culture to bring disasters on themselves. The problem is that when they bring disaster on themselves, some other people are chosen to inflict this disaster. So we know how the German people are driven by guilt. And I'm not getting now into the very crucial question whether they should be or not. I obviously think that they should move on. But it looks as if the Arabs and the Palestinians are the next goyim du jour, the next people who are going to inflict disaster on the Jews. As we can see, the situation in the Middle East, when this thing happened, a lot of people are dying around. We can already see what is happening in Syria and in Iraq. I think that not pointing at the lobbies that led us into this situation in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, not to mention that Bernard Henri Lévy said in front of the French people on French TV, I liberated Libya as a Jew. Not to point at the neoconservative as a Zionist Jewish school of thought is a crime, not just against the Iraqi people or the Libyan. It's a crime against the West and against the Jews. To call a spade is an ethical, necessary move towards peace.
In Alcoholics Anonymous, the first step to solving your problem is admitting that you got one.
Yes, I just gave 2 hours talking about that, because this is exactly how I teach music. I tell my music students, all you have to do is to identify your problems, which is very, very difficult. For most people, including myself, it is very, very difficult to admit that we have a problem. And why? Because once we have a problem, the first thing that we will develop is a form of denial. So most people are living in denial. But if we want to get better, we must
get angry and then start bargaining. And then start getting depressed, and then accept that you've got the problem.
This is one way around it, definitely. It is an agonizing process, and I do believe that this is exactly the role of the real historian. The real historian is the person who understands the past as we move along. So the past is changing all the time, because as we move along, we see our past differently. If we see our past differently, we see the future differently. Once we understand that, we understand that the notions of past, present, and future are very elastic. We understand the real meaning of temporality. And this is something that I realized that doesn't exist in Jewish culture. In Jewish culture and Jewish heritage, there is no such a thing as history. Jews didn't write a single history book between Josephus Flavius, that is Roman time, to Gratz, that is like late 18th century. Why they didn't write history? Because in order to understand what to do, how to act, they look at the Old Testament, at the Talmud. This lack of ability to deal with temporality created a very unique culture. And this is exactly the culture that led to Zionism. If we listen to Shlomo Zand, Jews really invented themselves. They invented themselves because they were not committed to any historical thinking. And if tomorrow there will be a problem in Palestine, they can invent themselves in New Zealand and take your land and decide that it's the promised land.
I'd like to see that, actually. It'd be quite funny. New Zealand getting invaded by the Israeli military just because it's the promised land. It's like, you can't do that. We've got white people here that you can't have a whole lot of supremacist, racist, Zionist support against. All right? You're not going to have billions of dollars for your war machine to invade a country full of white people unless they're Eastern European or Slavic, you know? Something like that. Or they're Russian. You see, it's the thing. If you've got people who are too similar to your culture, it's far too difficult to see them as an actual enemy that you'd want to kill. Right? Canadians and Americans dislike each other a lot. You know, they've got this kind of rivalry going on. A very similar rivalry exists between New Zealanders and Australians, but we don't kill each other like the rivalry between the Jews and the Palestinians in Israel right there. You see what I'm saying? Right?
I have something. I wish you were right here. If you look at the Bolshevists in the early 20s, 30s, 20th century, you look at the Holodomor, you see what they did to the Ukrainian people. Bolshevism was largely a Jewish movement. At the time, Yuri Slezkin, probably the best historian of Jews of that era, wrote in his book that won many Jewish kind of awards, the Jews were Stalin executioners. We look at the Holodomor. It's definitely the biggest crime of the 20th century. Some historians said that as many as 10 million Ukrainians were starved to death by these Bolsheviks in the process of collectivization.
Directly after they confiscated all of their guns.
The color of your skin, Ukrainians look very much like Jews, and it didn't stop the Jews wiping them out. The same happened in America. If you look at American Jews, they look very much like American people, I guess. And still, the bankers that run Wall Street, all these wolves, and George Soros engage in different speculations that actually wipe many classes in America, turn them into underclass, and demolish their prospect of any future. So this is something that we have to understand when it comes to racism and ethnicity. Although Jews are not a race and there is no Jewish racial continuum, Jewish culture is extremely racist. You don't have to be a race in order to be racist. And this formation of racist ideology creates the condition for their oligarchy that allows it to engage in some horrible, disastrous exercises.
You just described democide, which is the leading cause of death in the 20th century. What's democide, ladies and gentlemen? It's when you elect a government that exterminates you. And it's the leading cause of death in the 20th century. Your own government's killed more people than any other factor.
Yeah, I think that one of the most interesting things that happened in the 20th century, or let's say the last quarter of the 20th century and the 21st century, and I speak quite a lot about it, is due to the transformation of productive capitalist society into a service capitalism, and due to the evolvement of robotics and computer science, there is hardly any need of manual workers, and there is a growing need of people who are cognitive able, able in that they are slightly more sophisticated. This situation creates a very small elite of very intelligent people and a growing population that is classified as underclass. So people usually talking about middle class disappearing. It's not that middle class disappearing. It's the underclass becoming bigger and bigger. And what we see now in America, in Britain, a lot of people within oligarchy insist that actually there is no room anymore for the democratic game.
Now, unfortunately, that is all we have time for today, ladies and gentlemen. Gallard, thank you very much for spending an hour with me. And do you have a website there where people can go get your books and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's gillad.co.uk, gillad.co.uk.
All right, awesome. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after the break on American Freedom Radio.